Hello and welcome to Towards the Point, a cultural barometer for Pompey and beyond. I'm James Sandy, and in this show we get all conceptual and deceptive with a new exhibition of Jamie Shovlin's work. We soak up the acoustic wave of Turin Breaks and chat to them about their new album, We Were Here. We consider the focus of pop biopic on the casualties of popular culture, and we also attempt to stack your diary with some choice events in and around the city. Back from the brink, well-oiled and fresh on the canvas, is Simon Mobbs.
Evening.
He's here with us again, and making the crystal set sparkle forevermore is the father of the airwaves himself, Dave Allen.
You're so kind.
I do try. And we're going to start this show with art, and conceptual art, and an interesting one, a strange one, Simon, and this links to a new exhibition at the Southampton City Art Gallery.
It does indeed. Jamie Shovlin, and the title of the exhibition is How Most of What You Know is Reconstruction. So already we know we're in for something quite conceptual here.
That's a curious title already.
It mixes graphic design, kind of pop art style appropriation, traditional 2D art materials, graphite, paint, watercolour, 3D installations, quite a range of stuff really, and it wraps it all up in this quite conceptual art kind of package. Some of the work, there's three particular rooms. Some of them are presenting his own work alongside that of collections from the actual Southampton City Gallery's permanent collection, and some of it is just his own work in its own inner room. It's dealing with time, object, memory and experience. That's the general idea behind what groups it all, quite often relating to popular culture, graphic design, album covers on records, magazines like Time magazine, that kind of thing. The main kind of thrust of it really is the second gallery, which is the Fontana Modern Masters series that he produced, and this is the first time this series has all been put together in one place. This has been, parts of it have been showcased in quite major gallery spaces in London, Haunch of Venison, places like that. He's supported by Saatchi. He's got a big kind of, you know, presence in the art world. This Fontana Modern Masters series is basically him painting at quite a large canvas scale, probably like 6 foot or so, painting academic textbooks from the 70s. So, for example, in this series, you've got one on Dostoevsky, on Foucault, and so on. Basically, these original publications, which I'm sure Dave will be able to tell us more about in a minute, because I know he had some actually back in the 70s. These have been repainted up to quite a large scale, and they're very abstract. They involve a lot of kind of geometric shapes, simple colours. They don't have actual illustrations of these theoreticians or writers on the front. They go for a purely abstract kind of look.
So there's basically, I think, around 17 book covers, which some of which were never released. They were released as books, but they weren't released as covers to those books.
That's
and the
right.
Series was kind of, I think, 70 to 84, I think, is the kind of time period we're looking at. There's a word, redux, okay, which I've never really understood what that means. But I think I know what it means. Dave might be able to help explain what redux is. It's not something you get from acid indigestion. I think we should be very clear about that. But it's an idea of, I think, reconstituting other pieces of art to make new art.
Is that
what, am I in the right ballpark?
I think you are. And I think when you initially look at these, you assume they've all been kind of painted from original 70s versions. I think just it's worth explaining they've got an abstract, a modernist, a geometric, a flat, very man-made kind of look. But part of the process is that he's then imagined that there's an extra selection of books that were never released. So he's come up with a load of theoreticians, a load of artists, a load of writers that deserve to maybe be in that series but never quite got there. And he's redesigned the book cover to fit in with the original style that the ones were produced in. And there's quite a complicated kind of process to do that. So, for example, there's a particular infographic type piece in the exhibition space, which has this big spiral of all the kind of books in the series. And he comes up with all these different ideas. So which colour equals what kind of genre they wrote in, what kind of era they were working in might equal what geometric shapes he places. The angles that these shapes go at could, you know, equal something else, or the age of the artist when they died, all sorts of things like that. And he's come up with this very kind of convoluted, it probably makes sense to him, but it's very hard to decipher looking at this infographic ourselves.
So it's a kind of, I mean, it's a colour wheel, isn't it? It's a kind of paint chart. Well, is what it's loosely based on. So you can supposedly decipher one thing in the series from another. But as you said, the logic isn't quite clear because it's his alone, I guess.
He's kind of tried to get below the surface of what those designers were thinking in the 70s, and presumably they had some kind of methodology to decide what abstract shapes and what colours went on each book cover. He's tried to get underneath the skin of that and then redesign, well, not redesign, just design new covers for, you know, other artists, designers, other theoreticians who weren't covered. It's a very complex methodology. I looked at it for a good 10 minutes. I couldn't work out quite how he got to it, but there's clearly something going on there, and it gives the whole exhibition a kind of little bit of a twist. But I think that kind of maybe gets away from the idea of these actual canvases. That's the main thing, the impact of these things when you go in the room, seeing things that would normally be an A5 book blown up to a 6-foot painted canvas. There's something very assertive about the room when you go in, like these big, bold, flat, abstract colours jumping out at you.
And there's also, I think, some of the book covers he's chosen to reinvent or reuse are missing their titles. He's focusing on the individual rather than the title. Now, I wondered whether he's doing that to further confuse. I mean, I'm a little bit lost with this, I have to say, because I haven't been along to the exhibition, but I looked at some of his work, and it's quite commercial looking in terms of, you look at it and think, I get that, it's a commercial, clean graphic design for a series of books for, you know, kind of... Mm. I think the books are significant, actually, because they're some of the great thinkers and some of the kind of big ideas, but he's trying to deconstruct them as covers and make them works of art. And I wonder whether he's purposely left some of those things out to make a point, or whether he's just kind of merging it all into a grander picture I don't understand. Maybe Dave, you can throw some light on this. You're looking baffled already.
I mean, it's all a bit new to me at this particular work and this particular artist. I mean, they're just so I just keep jotting down things as you guys are talking, and I'm beginning to look online and so on. I mean, one of the obvious comments to make about it in terms of what Simon said about shift of scale is its obvious relationship to something like Warhol's Brillo boxes and things like that. So if I'm going to play the devil's advocate, which I might do without actually disliking the work, there's a bit of me that thinks that at the minute I'm neither seeing nor hearing anything that is that new or astonishing, and you've introduced the idea of redux, which I think is interesting. Given that I am the crystal set old fogey in the room, without any question whatsoever.
Finally tuned.
And the thing about redux, because again, I've just looked that up, because it seemed to me that what we were talking about there was something that's equally called intertextuality, but the idea about redux is being brought back. So it seems to me that maybe what he's doing is two things here. He's bringing back books that I am very familiar with, some of these covers, and certainly, you know, when I was trying to come to terms with somebody like Walter Benjamin, whose work whose ideas I like very much, I do remember reading the Walter Benjamin book, for instance. So he's bringing back that, but he's also bringing back the kind of thing that Warhol did, in terms of taking plain graphic images that are common in the world, or at least certainly familiar to people like me, and turning them into something else. And the other note that I made to myself was, why did he particularly choose the Modern Masters series? And it might be an explanation that what he did there was to take images. The covers of these books are very modernist. They're very flat, abstract images. You know, they're very much kind of high modernist graphics. So Modern Masters, modern images. But he's a conceptual artist, which, you know, in its latest phase since about 1970, has been the thing that's sat alongside postmodernism and followed modernism. So, you know, there's this sort of distancing where a conceptual artist is working within modernism but not working within modernism because of how he's playing with it. But it can get a bit convoluted, and I think one of the consequences of being my age is that sometimes I want to be moved a bit more by work than I am at the minute by this. And I think that's what I just said is absolutely true. There are periods in my life where I would have been absolutely excited by the intellectual characteristic of this work and by what, you know, the explanations he's constructing around it. And these days, it's a bit like redux for me. I kind of feel like been there already. I've seen that. I actually know that most of the things I know are reconstructed, and I can sit at home and you know, remind myself of that without taking a trip to Southampton. So what's left? Nothing much in my heart at the minute. So, you know, which may be unfair on him. But
well, that sounds a bit sad. So I think we should broaden that out. And I think we broaden that out by looking at his work in general, because he's done a lot of other things. Now, one thing when I was reading around his kind of his resume, his back catalogue, if you like, there are themes here. One theme is kind of the term misdirection kept coming up. You know, he's trying to divert people from what they're seeing and thinking initially, which is interesting. That interests me. He's trying to take them, you know, in different... He's trying to get them to a juncture and then move them in a direction maybe they don't expect. Now, some of the things that he's famous for have been hoaxes or fibs, okay? Uh-huh. And the thinking behind that, the concept behind that, I think, what he's trying to get to and what Dave's perhaps not feeling on a day-to-day basis in his heart is this kind of gradual realisation of things.
Yeah.
It's the point at which people realise, oh, yeah, it is a con, it is a trick, this doesn't exist.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and that maybe is what he himself, that maybe that's his kick, maybe that's what he gets from it, but that he's trying to kind of focus on that feeling.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. There's a definite element of hoax to a lot of his work. It's got quite a knowing, wry kind of feeling to it. There's a kind of sense of humour coming through it. He often creates backstories for his work. So, for example, the way he first really got into the art world was that he created this fictional character who was a disappeared schoolgirl, and he imagined that there was these works created by her. But when he presented it to the art world, he didn't actually say this is a fictional character. He presented it as a real person, and they bought it, and they went ahead, and this exhibition took place. Charles Saatchi became interested in his work, and this is how he got into the art world, effectively, through this hoax. At a later point, it was revealed that this wasn't true. He's also, for example, created a non-existent German glam rock band called Lustfaust.
I was very excited about that, and this is exactly the point, really. I was really disappointed when I learned that that wasn't a real thing.
He created this whole network of websites to kind of create this myth, and all these kind of myths about how their artwork was produced. So, for example, cassettes of theirs would have been designed by their fans and things like that. They sold blank cassettes with the idea that people created artwork from. He created this whole backstory, and he doesn't simply want to fool the audience, but as you say, he wants them to gradually realise that they're being tricked, a bit like advertising does often nowadays. It doesn't try to kind of pull the wool over your eyes. It tries to let you feel like you're in on the joke and feel like you're kind of got a wry smile with the advertising team as well. I think that's what he's doing with the work.
There was a period in my student days, which is a few decades ago, where I was very, very interested in hard edge abstract painting. And one of the things that struck me again and again when I went and looked at the real stuff, whether it was the old masters like Mondrian or the newer American guys, like, I mean, Ellsworth Kelly springs to mind, but there were others as well, was precisely that actually what you saw was texture and surface and things that were not quite crisp straight lines, you know, when they were painted, which in reproduction always looked like it, which I found absolutely delightful, because I remember loving Mondrian and doing a project on Mondrian as a student, and some people saying to me a bit the kind of thing that I've been saying, you know, which is, where's the heart in it, you know? And what I said was, if you go and see it, you can see the heart, because you can see the hand that doesn't quite hold firm as he paints and so on. And it may be that the comments I've made so far are comments that you would make, wouldn't you, if what you do is look at these images on an iPad, which is what I'm doing, and it's entirely unfair to do it, you know, which, of course, you know, when I first saw Mondrian, what you did was you saw him in books. There weren't iPads, you know, or you might see him on an Open University telly programme, but you wouldn't see him on an iPad.
But there's something interesting in that, in terms of how you experience this art, and it is conceptual art, so it's always going, in my mind, it's always going to be a bit wonky. Some of this is about, and some of the reviews I read, some of this is about hacking or hijacking genres and ways of expressing and ways of expressing through art. Now, you mentioned the German glam rock band that never was, the Lustfaust, I believe they were called, and they might be touring soon, you know, they're playing the Guildhall. But there was another thing that I looked at, which was a fake kind of 70s slasher movie, a kind of B movie called Hiker Meat, which was very peculiar and looked very much like Texas Chainsaw Massacre. You know, it had that kind of horrible, dark, kind of sepia, grainy film quality, but a lot of work had gone into making it look very much like something from that era and that period. And I thought, well, actually, I'm looking at this believing everything that comes across. You know, I'm believing that this is an excerpt from a horrible slasher film about some cult who worship a worm or something, something crazy. But what I didn't get was the point of that. You know, I get you can replicate that, and I get you can fool people. But to me, what's the message? What difference does it make to me?
Yeah, and I think answering that question, also linking back to what we just said a minute ago about reproduction, it reminds me a bit of seeing a piece of pop art in a gallery. So, for example, if you see Lichtenstein or a Warhol piece, what's quite often happening, particularly say with Lichtenstein, is he's taking say a pulp novel or a graphic cartoon, an illustration from a cartoon. It was only a few centimetres big, maybe, and blowing it up to gallery-sized proportions and reducing the image a little bit and tweaking it a bit so it becomes this huge, big canvas, like the Wham one with the plane kind of making an explosion or, you know, things like that. But then when we then see it again, it's then been reduced down onto our iPad, it's been reduced down onto a printed page. So all those things that happen in the gallery about it becoming huge and it becoming this big, almost sort of, almost abstract scale, you know, those cartoons get so big. I think that's the same with Jamie Shevlin's work. It becomes so big and then it gets reduced down again. So there's like this threefold sort of version, you know, something gets taken from popular culture, a graphic design, for example, book, it gets blown up to a massive big painting and then it gets shrunk down again to something even smaller than so there's several stages here of reproduction.
There was a catalogue, I think, available of the exhibition, which I looked at online.
Yeah.
Everything's online, I think, these days. But I looked at it and it said, right at the beginning, in the kind of foreword, it said, this catalogue has been arranged, not in any particular way, it's for the reader to arrange and to work out how you experience the exhibition and the catalogue. And what they were suggesting was that you could put the pages together as a large jigsaw, basically, to make your own artwork.
Yeah.
You know, and I like that idea. There's an interactivity to that. But it kind of throws me slightly.
Yeah.
That throws up two questions for me, really. One is increasingly intrigued by the notion of conceptual art, you know, because it kind of implies that anything before, apart from Duchamp, anything before about 1970 didn't have any conceptual underpinning. Whereas if you go and look at, what we nowadays think of as the fairly realist paintings of Manet, for instance, they comment endlessly on the social mores of the time and interactions and so on. So to suggest that that's not conceptual is a kind of odd idea anyway. So I think sometimes that's a problematic term. The other interesting thing about it is this. If you then produce a catalogue that's actually, to a large extent, you know, the things we've talked about are book covers and film posters, what's missing is the content. So you can go and see the cover of the Walter Benjamin, but you can't read about Walter Benjamin. You can go and see the poster for the film, but you can't see the film. And so they then produce a catalogue which is full of inside, is full of outsides. You know, somewhere I want to know where the content's gone, you know, and what we, because actually that thing about the genre and the style of slasher movie posters is something that's equally well done in some respects by cultural theorists who don't actually make work at all. They just have lecture rooms full of young students and I was one of them. You put these things on a wall, on a screen, and you talk about them. So, but it's quite nice. I mean, I think the success of it in some respects is that we're managing to have a quite intriguing conversation about whether it works or not, and therefore it works.
Indeed, it works. We'll put it down on the list as one that works. Simon, for those folks that want to go along and have a look at the exhibition, just remind us of the details.
Okay, so Jamie Shevlin's exhibition, How Most of What You Know Is Reconstruction, is on at the Southampton City Art Gallery, and it's on until December.
We move now to music, and excitingly, recently Turing Breaks popped into Pie and Vinyl and they had time for a chat about their new album, We Were Here. Okay, so I'm in the back room of Pie and Vinyl, and very excitingly I'm joined by Turing Breaks, who are Ed.
Hello.
Ollie.
Yep, hello.
Gail.
Present.
And Rob.
Konnichiwa.
Thank you very much. We've done the register. You've played an outstanding set, a great set. Really love the stuff that you did. And really intimate as well. A little bit humid at points, but you couldn't help that.
We were heating the place up.
Tell me about your tell me about the new album, We Were Here. Tell me about that, because I think there's a theme to that. Is it a time capsule? Is that kind of the idea?
I don't know if there's exactly a theme, but there's an atmosphere that we were going for that is, I suppose, we were interested in, you know, that idea of people leaving a mark. I like the idea that humans, over the years, have, for one reason or another, scratched their names into things. You know,
it's a kind of legacy thing.
Yeah, or a desperation for a legacy. I like that. The kind of, I've got to scratch my name into this brick wall.
Do you think there's a kind of air of resignation about it as well? Sort of saying, you know, this is our time. This is kind of, we've done and we've passed. Or is it kind of, is it less pessimistic than that?
It could be that. I don't think that's what we really believe, but maybe some people do. I don't know.
Do you mean humanity in general, or just the four of us in particular?
Well, it's a wider question.
Okay, it's the wider question.
I'll start with the four of you, maybe.
Okay, we're definitely here.
We're still here.
We haven't passed yet, so and that's no resignation.
We haven't gone yet.
That's a great thing. And this is your sixth studio album, is that right?
Yeah.
So you've kind of been quite busy, really, over the last 10, 15 years?
Yeah, 14 years we've been alive as a band, yeah.
Wow. And the band's bigger this time, isn't it, in some ways? Because usually, I think, Ollie and Gail, you're...
We picked these two guys up about 6 months ago. These two men have been with us since 2000. So almost as long as the band's existed. But me and Gail, to be honest, even though we came up with the name Tune Breaks in 1999, we've been kind of messing around with this idea since we were about 10.
There's quite a kind of fraternity, isn't there, between the two of you? Kind of since you were in Small Trousers, you've been
jamming away and rocking our lives have been very intertwined. You know, shared lots of wonderful memories and things. Yeah.
Musically, how do you reckon this is a different album? Because there's a classic, I think, Turing Breaks sound that comes through in the new album, and the album's only been out just over, well, nearly a week, in fact. But you know, how do you think it sounds different from The Optimist, you know, sort of your opener?
It's definitely kind of playing with a lot of the sounds that we had, that we kind of invented around our first record. And it's the first time we've ever consciously gone, what would happen if we kind of took those sounds now and made a record now?
Yeah.
It's obviously very different as well, really. If you listen to the two back to back, you realise they're pretty different. But I think it's the first record where we thought, well, what is, you know, we really truly thought, what is Turing Breaks? What do we want to keep from this idea of Turing Breaks, and what do we want to throw away, and what do we want to be new? And it's the first time we've ever done that. You know, normally we just go head first into a record. We don't think, we just do it. And this is because we've been going quite a long time, we've kind of looked back and thought, you know, maybe we can consider what we're doing a little bit more here. And so we did, and these guys, the rest of the guys, were really involved as well, because, you know, they have a perspective on it all as well.
And it's been brewing, I think, for the last 3 years. You've been kind of writing it and pulling it together, and I guess that process has changed as well, as you've got, you know, these guys coming in and, you know, sort of being reflective, but also want to do new things.
What do you think, Rob?
I suppose over the last few years, what's happened is that things have changed, you know, sort of behind the scenes anyway, like changes of management and changes of how everything's set up and how we kind of do things. And I think that's why this record, one of the reasons why this record is like it is sort of reflected in a more of a kind of gang mentality.
Because we changed our accounting system.
Yeah, we changed the accounting system. Yeah. But basically, it's more, I think it is a little bit more of a kind of group mentality, gang mentality, because we tend to do everything ourselves and everyone mucks in. So that's kind of why it's developed in that way. It's kind of almost like a sort of artistic development of what's gone on, you know, around the practicalities. So it's kind of fitting in a way.
Well, let me ask you about that accounting system, because Time and Money, I think the first single
it's
off the
about
album,
accounting.
Is it a protest song against bankers and kind of corporate greed? It's got a very, let's just say, Reservoir Dog style video.
Video definitely is. I mean, the video is pulling those elements out of the song, I think. Those elements are definitely in the song. It's not really a political song, to be honest, but it's a bit of a reaction to like what's happened in the last few years. And there was a point just after the government got in, there was a bit of fear that they were going to kind of kill the colour. You know, that's the only way I can really describe it.
Yeah.
I remember when we were kids under Maggie Thatcher, and there was a point where it felt very grey. I was very young, but I remember colour just didn't seem to be there. The money for the colour didn't seem to be there, you know. By colour, I just mean the creative side of the world. And there was a bit of worry about that, you know. So I think that came through in that song a lot, you know.
And it opens up a bit of a dilemma, that song, because it's, you know, if you could have more time or money, what would you have? More time.
Yeah.
How do you guys feel? Time, money, what do you...
A mixture of the both.
A mixture.
I'll go for both. Time and money.
Yeah. All the time and all the money you've got.
One of the other tracks that sticks out for me on the album is No Mercy, which is a real, I think, I suppose you could call it a an anthem in some ways. You know, it's a real ballad. Would you say it's a track that's about an attitude, or is it more about an environment around it?
Even though I suppose I wrote it, I don't really know what it is exactly. I know where I go in my own head, and it was in a place where I go on holiday, where I go on holiday with my kids, and it's just outside of London, and there's a very special feeling about it, and it does make you feel, when you're there, you really feel like you're in a bubble, and you really feel like the world is a bloody dangerous place outside of this wonderful little bubble. And I just, it just bubbled up in a song, you know. It has very universal themes that can be applied to a lot of things, but for me it has a personal place that I go to. It's a space, it's an atmosphere. Most Turing Break songs are more about atmospheres than stories.
I think it's a very passionate song. I mean, that comes across quite a kind of slow burn passion, if you like, but I think that comes across. Tell me about the physical release, because the record, very excitingly, the vinyl record is a colour splatter edition, which is, for people that don't know what that is, that means it's coloured vinyl, okay? Yeah. And the album cover is very interesting as well. There's a kind of cosmos, isn't it? A kind of, what was the feel behind that? Was it kind of, it looks quite arresting, the image. It's quite sort of, but quite familiar in some ways.
It's a great artist called Sam Chivers, who we've done a few things with, some posters and artwork in the past. And Sam is, he's got a real look about his stuff that we just respond to straight away, and it seems to somehow tap into what it is we're feeling, what the music is doing, and so we kind of went to him and gave him free rein. We said, this is the name of the record, this is kind of, you know, what we're trying to do, off you go, and gave him a little bit of music and said, off you go, and he produced that. Obviously we liked it straight away, and there was no argument.
It was a brilliant exchange between artists, you know. It was like, here's some music, here's a title, go. And he came back and we were like, yep. That's the image.
Like, could you just make it a little bit
more
green?
Could you de-pink it a bit?
Yeah, it was all just done.
Interesting from what you said, you know, about kind of colour and swirls and bubbles. It's that kind of thing. It looks kind of, I'm doing an injustice, but it's a kind of stirred paint pot, isn't it, in some ways?
People just look him up on samchivers.com, I think it is, or something, and he's just...
He does really good stuff for, like, the new scientist, but he does loads of... He's just a really good artist, but he does all these swirly, psychedelic kind of things.
There's something also slightly sort of almost like 50s-like about
some of his
work as well.
Retro and futuristic.
It was all those elements. It was very... It was kind of old-fashioned and very modern, and weirdly said a lot about the band right now as well, I think.
Now, I want to ask you a question about strings and about guitars, because your sound... It's quite unique, I think, in terms of, you know, it's a very accentuated string sound. You've got some mandolin plucking going on this one, which is quite...
It's not on a record, though.
Is it not?
No, I'm just... Strictly not. I just live for the moment with the mandolin.
For the moment.
It's here and then it's gone. You can't contain it. It can't be contained in a container.
So when
it has to exist in the now, and then in the then, it's gone.
Was it disallowed, was it?
Or was it banned?
It was banned, yeah.
It might have been banned.
There was a banjo at one point, and that was day one, no banjo, no mandolin.
I played two notes, I think.
Everyone went, no.
So what about your guitar sound? Have you got favourite guitars you take out? And Gail, you play an interesting-looking guitar. Kind of,
I did
quite
today,
a long cutaway guitar today.
Yeah, that one was custom-made for me, apparently, by a man in Lewes called Alice Ratkin.
Canterbury.
Apparently he lives in Canterbury now. Yeah, he must have moved.
He moved.
That's important for the warranty, I think. That.
Yeah, shacking down. Yeah, we've gone for a few guitars. Ollie's got a new Guild, which has changed everything. Mm-hmm. So he used to have his massive one. Now he's got his tiny little guitar. Yeah, I guess it's kind of important because the acoustics are what's pushing out a lot of the sound. So
we played a lot of. We have this nice old J50 Gibson J50 that we used. We've never used live, but we used it loads on the record, didn't we? That was kind of on every song, I think, pretty much.
And you've perfected, I think, something that's very difficult to master, which is the slide guitar.
Yeah.
Slide is, you know, a very difficult thing to...
Yeah.
To and
control.
Also, I noticed the slide itself you put on the right finger. If you put it on the wrong finger, you get it stuck on for days.
I've learnt that
as a novice.
It's hard to pick your nose with a slide.
It gives a great sound. Just moving on to some of your live performances. You're doing some in-stores like here at Pine Vinyl, but you're doing kind of smaller, kind of intimate gigs, but then you're going on quite a big tour from the end of October and towards the end of the year. And you've I think, been in Australia, haven't you, just prior prior to this tour? So in terms of the venues, you've got ones that you prefer? You prefer kind of, you know, where you can sort of mingle with the audience, have a cup of tea with the audience, or, you know, because you've done sort of big stadiums?
Yeah,
and
there's
and
a kind of, I don't know, it, I mean, it does change all the time, but there's a kind of perfect, I think there's a perfect place to see Tune Breaks, or for us to play at least, which is somewhere that's big enough, you know, for it to get the full width, you know, of what's going on. But it's small enough for it to feel like, you know, you're really there and it's an intimate experience. It's a real one-off experience. And sometimes the venues are just perfect and it's like we're all together with the crowd. We're all going off to Venus or something, you know.
So just a few dates that you've got coming up. You've got Bristol coming up on the 1st of November. You're playing Thekla, which is a boat, I think. So have you done that one before? I can't remember.
Done it lots of times, actually.
It has water sort of bilge, I think they call it.
They do.
Of, you know, occasionally sort of running up and down through the dressing room if it's a particularly rocky day.
We'll get your wellies on for that one. You've got Cardiff coming up on the 3rd of November at the Globe. Later in the month, you've got 16th of November, you've got Cambridge playing at the Junction 1. And High Wycombe, you're playing the Students' Union.
Mm-hmm.
It's been an exciting one.
Unusual gig.
Experimental.
That's experimental.
Yeah, that's what it's all about, I think. You're playing Shepherd's Bush Empire on the 20th of November, obviously in London. Oxford on the 21st at the Academy 2, and in Brighton at St George's on the 23rd of November. So you've got quite a busy period coming up. Now, I suppose the easy work's done now. You've made the album. You know, you've just got to take it out. That's what.
I like that. I like the way you think. I'm going to try and think
channel
like
that.
Yeah.
Try and do it that way. So, in terms of what is coming next, once you've toured, obviously you might do other tours. Have you got other records in the pipeline? Are there things that perhaps didn't make this album that you want to kind of work up? Or
oh God,
I mean, to ask a tricky question.
Yeah. I mean, there's always potential music in the pipeline. I think because things have gone quite well this week for us, we're definitely kind of having little conversations about what should we do next. It's very, very early for us. But you never know, there might be a few side projects as well, because there often are these days. And I mean, Ed just made a jazz record, didn't
he? That's true. Almost without meaning to.
Tell me about that then, an accidental jazz record.
It's just some tunes which I wrote and some jazz musicians that I know and a studio that was available, and I brought all those three things together and ended up with a jazz record.
What's it called, Ed?
It's called Why Worry.
And where do we find that, Ed?
Your front room.
In my front room.
Well, come round and have a look.
You can ask me for it. If anyone wants one, just ask me and you can get one.
I might borrow a tape off of you or something afterwards. So, anyway, it's been a real pleasure to catch up with you and to chat with you. I've been a fan of yours for a long time, so it's a real pleasure to come and meet you and have a chat with you. Best of luck on the tour and best of luck for the album. And let's keep our fingers crossed that it gets number one in the UK charts.
We're all expecting it. Yes. We're all fully expecting it. Either that or zero, I'd say, would be an even better number.
It's a round number. Yes. Okay, Turin Breaks, thank you very much.
Thanks very much.
Thank you. now to the pop biopic. Now, I had to be very careful how I said that. And Dave, you're going to explain, this is a murky world, but like most things, there's a point that we must move towards.
Yes, and the Turin Brakes thing, We Were Here, that's kind of funny, because there's a Bob Dylan biopic called I Was Here.
Indeed.
Which is pretty odd stuff. I think there are six actors playing Bob Dylan in that particular film, including Cate Blanchett. And a little black boy at one point, who's about 10 years old as well.
That's a very peculiar one.
I'm not fond of it at all, I have to say. We may not go any further with that one. In some ways, one of the things that made me think about this was the fact that there is a brand new Paul McCartney album out, and I'm not inclined to say, I don't know anything about it, I haven't heard it.
It's called New, I think.
It is, yes. Well, that's a good idea, really, I suppose, in the way that Please Please Me's old.
It's not the Frog Chorus, is it? He hasn't gone down the Frog Chorus route again.
I think there is a really interesting question about Paul McCartney, given his status and his impact and his influence on popular music. And this is really just a way into this larger topic. There are two fictional, even that is a difficult term to use. What do we mean by that? There are two fictional movies about the Beatles. Now, they're not fictional because they're based on real events, but they're...
Do they call them factional? Do they call that?
Well, we could do that if you want.
Yeah, that's cool.
Feature films, anyway. There are two feature films. One is called Nowhere Boy, which is about John Lennon, and one is Backbeat, which is to a very large extent about Stu Sutcliffe, the Beatle who couldn't really play but was a really fine artist and died of a brain hemorrhage, I think, at a very young age.
And was he a Beatle or was he a Quarryman? Were they moved?
Oh, no, he was a Beatle.
Moved?
Okay, yeah, right. They were the Beatles by then, yeah. Yeah, in Hamburg. But what's interesting is that Lennon is large in both, and of course McCartney appears in both, but there has never been a movie about McCartney. And my simple premise is that he's just too jolly nice. He makes nice songs, he's always cheery, he's got his thumbs up and he's smiling all the time, and therefore in some sense this is a blindingly obvious point, because the same thing is true of movies about artists. So, you know, if you look at a film like Kirk Douglas in Lust for Life, you know, why Van Gogh? Because Van Gogh was crackers and cut his ear off, you know. There is a film about Picasso, but it's a much more obscure film. You know, there is one about Jackson Pollock. Why Jackson Pollock? Because he drank himself to death and drove into a tree at the age of about 35 and killed himself, you know. So that's kind of...
It makes a good screenplay, that kind of thing, doesn't it?
It makes a good screen. And, I mean, people have always done it. Not exclusively, even in the pop world. So if you look at Clint Eastwood, who's a huge jazz fan, when he makes a music biopic, who does he pick? Charlie Parker, the great casualty. He doesn't pick Louis Armstrong, who's a colossus, or Duke Ellington, who's another colossus of the jazz world at a certain point. He picks Charlie Parker, who's equally a colossus, you know, transforms popular music in the post-war period, but is usefully also a drug addict.
And that's the film Bird, I think, isn't it?
It is the film Bird, yes, indeed. There's a parallel movie. I'm not that fond of it, really. It just seems to me to pay too much attention to that. And I want to say two things. Firstly, if you're going to make a narrative drama, there's got to be something dramatic. Okay, so not Paul McCartney, yes, John Lennon, you know, not simply because of John Lennon's own life and so on, but because of the tragedy of being abandoned by his mother and then finding his mother, and then his mother dies tragically in a road accident. So all of those things, although actually there were similar things in McCartney's life. So, but you do need, a strong element of dramatic narrative. But that's not actually why we care about those people, you know. And if we throw some of the other names into the pot, it's not why we care about Johnny Cash or Ray Charles. Simon was mentioning Kurt Cobain, and I know that there is a film called Kurt and Courtney by Nick Broomfield, the documentary maker, but wasn't really going to encroach on documentary so much. But you're telling us that there is a kind of fictionalised ish Kurt and Courtney called Last Days.
Yes, yeah, or Kurt on his own. I think by then, I don't know if they were in a relationship as much, but it's set in the last two or three days of his life. It's made by Gus Van Sant, who kind of treads a line between, you know, art house and mainstream cinema. And it's got quite an art house feel to it. It's, some of the shots are very long. They look almost like paintings. It stays on the same shot for that amount of time. It's got very little talking in it. And it, as you can imagine, it explores somebody from more or less start to finish of their last few days. What did they get up to? What journals did they write? Who came to visit them? There's quite a funny scene where somebody tries and sells him insurance, and he's in another
place.
You need
a bit of humour in a dark biopic about Kurt Cobain, I guess.
But he's not actually called Kurt in it. They give him another name, just to sort of... It's clearly him. All the kind of references of the way he's dressed, it's clearly him, the era it's set and everything. But they probably couldn't get the legal rights to use his name. But that's a very interesting one, because it doesn't take the whole of his life. No. It just takes a little snippet of it. Mm. And I find that quite interesting, because I sometimes find that the format of the biopic can be a bit tired, even if I'm really interested in the musician.
Mm. Ray is a good example, which goes from childhood, early blindness, gigging on the road with Lowell Fulsom, you know, trying to find a way of not being Nat King Cole II, all the way through, on and on and on.
And if it's that one, or the Johnny Cash ones, or any of these, I find them... Like the format, you see them in their early years, you see them get, you know, maybe it's an addiction, maybe it's some kind of other problem, you see a relationship that maybe does or doesn't work, normally doesn't, and then I find that the format is relatively tired, but then there's some which sort of example, like 24 Hour Party People, which kind of break away from that a bit, like they put another twist on it, they put a comedy twist on it, or they introduce more characters, and I think you can do it in an interesting way, but I find it a little bit testing to kind of see that same story fold out.
Same for you?
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I'm not a big fan of the biopic, I have to say. Mm. And I think there are films like Walk the Line, you know, which I love, but I love it because I love Johnny Cash. You know, and I know Dave and I had a discussion prior to this, and Dave, I think, didn't really get Johnny Cash.
I don't get Johnny Cash.
That's fair, you know. No. But it's fair enough. And I think, you know, it brings you go to that film because you think, oh, yeah, someone, you know, someone's going to have a go at being Johnny Cash. That must be interesting. You know, in the same way that Kurt Russell being Elvis is interesting. You know, you kind of you get into it after a while, and you kind of, you know, there are things that you could suspend, and you have to agree that it's a film. There are other films, I think, like there's a film Shine, which is about David Helfgott, the pianist, and that is a fantastic film. Now, not many people know about him or about his work or kind of, you know, his circumstance, but that film catapulted his work and his back catalogue out to a much broader audience. So I think there's a tendency, and I think one of the things, one of the points that you're making, David, there's a tendency to focus on the dark and the casualty and the kind of the broken elements of superstars and, you know, kind of celebrities. But actually, there are some positive stories that come through some of these biopics. But the danger is that the positivity launches them into kind of, you know, rather kind of mainstream films.
We're drawn to that idea of a tortured artist, I think.
Yeah.
And we want them to have some kind of, well, I don't really want, but we seem to be drawn to stories where there's some kind of horrific conclusion, or where they have they have to struggle with something throughout their life. A lot of this music, rock and so on, has its roots in blues music, and blues music is people singing about their everyday woes, singing about their problems, and there can actually be something quite life-affirming to hear somebody acknowledge maybe issues, problems that you felt, and also possibly even life-affirming to sort of hear that their problems are possibly even worse than yours. And I don't find, when I listen to a blues record, that I feel depressed. I find something strangely uplifting about it. Sure. I don't know if it's the same with whether it's Kurt Cobain, whether it's the guy from Joy Division or what have you. We like the idea that they were tortured, and therefore their music can speak to us about real turmoil, about real issues. There's something deep and kind of more plausible about it because they've been so tortured. Whereas Paul McCartney, there's something that feels a bit more frothy and a bit light about it because he's such a jolly chap. We don't quite kind of buy it as much.
I think there are some great figures in popular music through the whole century. In a sense, the thing that troubles me is rather more, to go back to the Jamie Shovlin thing, it's about reconstructing histories and saying, it's almost like saying, if you want to be a significant artist of any kind, you know, whether it is Van Gogh, you know, or Kurt Cobain or anybody else in any medium, you've got to be a bit crazy, a bit unhinged, and so on and so on. And that simply, you know, for example, was not true of Louis Armstrong, and it wasn't true of Duke Ellington. It's not really true of Bob Dylan, for all the kind of oblique strategies he's employed in his life. It's certainly, talking of oblique strategies, not true of somebody like Brian Eno. I'm not aware that it's true of Tom York, you know, and I'm just trying to go through a whole kind of history of popular music as quickly as I can. And yet, one of the things when I was talking to somebody about preparing for this show, I said, you know, it would not surprise me to know that the next film, the next cab off the rank, will be Amy Winehouse.
Yeah.
Mm. You know,
yeah.
And again, it's this kind of, well, if you want to make this great music, you've got to be crazy. You've got to take loads of drugs and mess yourself up. And I think that the danger is that becomes embedded in the culture.
Yeah.
And it's simply not true that it has to be that way.
Yeah.
You know, it can be other than that.
And it's across all genres, isn't it? I mean, whether it's across rap music with people like Tupac Shakur and like Notorious B.I.G., whether it's in rock with like Kurt Cobain, we pop Amy Winehouse, we're just drawn to that idea of someone who's in some way a martyr and can speak to us about our individual strifes.
I think you're absolutely right, Dave. I think, you know, for a lot of these films there's a very poor representation of their actual life and the context of their life, you know, and you're right that, you know, Amy Winehouse the movie is, you know, destined to be made. Who they'll cast, you know, as the lead, who God knows. But when you look at a film like The Doors, you know, you've got Val Kilmer being Jim Morrison, amazing. You know, the transformation is amazing. For many people, you think, oh, wasn't that guy in The Doors? You know, is it kind of, there's a blurring, if you like. But the film, from my recollection of the film, is it kind of stops at the point where he goes into free fall. You know, it kind of stops, I think, with the concert where he does or he doesn't do something lewd on stage. You know, kind of at a point where he's, you know, he's a shaggy, disheveled kind of character. And you kind of think, right, well, they've got a snapshot of the kind of apple pie of his life, okay? But they haven't got the heroin or the fag butts or the kind of broken window stuff.
I think that's interesting because I'm of that generation that who's listening to popular music was transformed by the bands from California in the late 60s when there'd been this British, you know, Beatles, Rolling Stones-led thing, and the Americans, as it were, fought back, and you suddenly got The Doors, Jefferson Airplane, The Byrds, Country Joe and the Fish, so on and so on. Jim Morrison was the craziest, furthest out, you know, biggest casualty of the lot. You know, so, for example, Country Joe and the Fish, who were my favourite Californian band from that time, and certainly as way out and wacko as any of them in terms of their appearances at Woodstock. The problem is they're all still alive, you know, and Jim Morrison, bless him, killed himself. So he's perfect for a movie, you know, and it's the same thing. And, you know, some of that early Doors stuff is absolutely fantastic. So is early Country Joe and the Fish, but only one of those two was ever going to be made into it. Same as, you know, which Rolling Stone have they made a biography of? Brian Jones, you know, who was hardly ever in them, you know. Keith ought to be a good subject, but surprisingly haven't. I was going to pick up on one other idea that Simon had, which is this idea of reconstruction, which is more fictional. So you've got the Kurt Cobain, except it's not really Kurt Cobain, it's only 3 or 4 days. And it did strike me that sometimes the most powerful films, I mean, I would put on the table, for example, because we just talked about the Rolling Stones, one of the most powerful representations of that late 60s rock musician going into a kind of disastrous demise is Performance, which is Mick Jagger being Mick Jagger, but it isn't Mick Jagger. It's entirely fictional. David Essex made 2 movies. He made That'll Be the Day and Stardust, and I certainly think That'll Be the Day is a pretty fine evocation of you know, a 50s grammar school kid who gets so excited by rock music that he ends up, you know, at the circus, then he joins a band and so on and so on, and eventually in the second film, which I'm not so fond of, but in the second film, Stardust, you know, he just becomes this kind of complete rock and roll casualty, and he's not playing David Essex, but he's playing you know, any number of people that are quite, you know, quite close. And I wonder, having had this conversation, whether those... Quadrophenia is a really, really good film about the mod thing, but there's this bloke on the edge of it who's a disaster, who has to be there to make it more than just a film about mods.
It's interesting, actually. I mean, another film from that kind of time is, that you know, The Man That Fell to Earth, the David Bowie sci-fi. Yeah. And, you know, it's very clearly not David Bowie in that film. It's more Ziggy Stardust in that film. And then you explore, well, who is Ziggy Stardust? Yeah. And he's a kind of creation of Bowie, Christ and Jean Genot, you know, is that kind of mix. And, you know, they're saying, well, this is another offshoot of that character, you know, and it's a kind of, it is a deconstruction, isn't it? It's relying on you to pull the other pieces together, isn't it? You know, and to also have a knowledge and a kind of, a familiarity with the works of those people involved.
Another biopic documentary that's relatively recent is the Scorsese one about George Harrison. And, you know, why did he choose that Beatle to produce? And he was giving reasons about how he felt. he said a lot about the zeitgeist of the time, like how he's been interested in different religions, which leaks back to the 60s, like Eastern religions and so on, the kind of interests he had, and very much how he was kind of behind the scenes, and he kind of, was it a 2-3 hour documentary? It was quite long.
Yeah,
it spread over a couple of nights when it was on the BBC.
There are a couple of examples, actually, currently, which are not necessarily just about rock stars or pop stars, if you want to call them that, but we've got the moment, I think, in production, or it's shaky what will happen with it, but we've got the Freddie Mercury biopic, which Sacha Baron Cohen was taking the lead role in, which I think could be really interesting because he's a great actor, known for Borat and other silly things, but you know, at the core of this guy is performance and his confidence, so he could be really good in that role if it ever, you know, gets to cinema, because I think there's been some wrangling around that. The other film which springs to mind, which it's not about a pop star, but there's this biopic, a kind of biopic, I suppose, about Julian Assange, you know, the Fifth Estate. And there's a lot in the media at the moment that, you know, this is the story of WikiLeaks, you know, with a bit of with a bit of intrigue and sexual mischief thrown in. But you kind of think, well, you know, what purpose is that film serving? Because, you know, we've barely had time to filter the information around the person, let alone the story. Is it just there because we think, oh, right, we can hit the zeitgeist, we can sell the tickets, let's get it done?
I wonder what Jamie Shovlin would do with that, because I think he would be very useful in a context like that. He would be very sceptical about, you know, what we've got to remember is a multi-million dollar industry jumping in on any topical, contentious, slightly dodgy, slightly iffy thing, and simply representing it to us.
What I'm keen to know is, do you have a favourite? Is there a biopic that sticks out in your mind that you think that's the key one that, you know, I could watch again and again? For me, and we mentioned this earlier on, there's a very good biopic of Ian Curtis, which is called Control, which is quite a harrowing view, let's call it that, but it's very good. It's very
beautifully shot,
very earthy, very realistic, very well shot. And it's a good one. It's a really good film.
Young Man with a Horn, starring Kirk Douglas, and he, it's based on the life of Bix Beiderbecke, and he plays opposite Doris Day, who's really sweet. And Doris Day appears in 2 or 3 biopics from that period, and she's always the sweet edge where there's something sour on the other side. It's the yin and yang thing, which works very well. But that's a beautiful film.
Simon, what about you?
I would say, for sheer kind of cinematic beauty, Last Days. I mean, if you want to cheer yourself up afterwards, 24-hour Party People.
Yeah, I like that.
That is a good one to go see. Just before we go, we've just got time to update you on a few activities and events for your diary. Excitingly, the three of us will be involved at an event at the Square Tower in Old Portsmouth on Saturday, the 9th of November. That's Tongues and Groob's 10th anniversary show. Poetry, there's music, there's all kinds of things going on, there's workshops. You can check out the details on their website. That's tonguesandgrooves.org.uk.
There's a general programme of art events called Art South Collaborations, which looks really interesting. It's 12 weeks of free exhibitions and free performances across Central and South England, including Portsmouth, the Isle of Wight, but also stretching out to Bournemouth and so on. But if you go to their website, artsouth.org.uk, there's absolutely tons of things listed which are going on for free. If you're looking particularly in Portsmouth, there's a kind of series of experimental slash interview based short films about the theme of true crime being showed at the Amiga Centre, and these have been produced by an artist called Jordan Baseman, but also with the collaboration of the Criminal Justice Department at the University of Portsmouth.
My stuff is all to do with the Palant Gallery in Chichester. Early November, there's Sean Scully, who's a quite major British abstract painter. There's some of his work going up there till the end of January. Currently on, there's an exhibition of Ben Nicholson, his father William Nicholson, his mum Mabel Pride, and all sorts of other Nicholsons, which is quite interesting. I don't think it's stunning, but it's quite interesting. End of November, Pauline Boaty, who for some time was a fairly obscure but is increasingly rediscovered British pop artist who died tragically young in 1966. But there's a show of hers which I think is very exciting news. And the fourth show there, which is on at the moment, Prince by Eric Revilius, who died in the Second World War and will be familiar to some people. There are a lot of them rural Prince. But what's really fascinating is that in the Second World War, at the start of the war, he was based in Gosport and Portsmouth, and there are a series of Prince prints about submarines in Gosport and Portsmouth Harbour. So that's all at the Pallant Gallery, either now or coming up in the next month.
If you're a fan of fine singing and songwriting, you can catch Eddie Reader at the Wedgwood Rooms on the 14th of November, and tickets are £20, and you can find out more details from their website, which is wedgwoodrooms.co.uk. That's it for this show. As I said, we'll be back with our November show, which is a special for the Tongues and Grooves event. If you want to find out more information, more details on some of the things we've been talking about through this programme or any of the programmes in the series, you can visit our blog, which is towardsthepoint.blogspot.com. Towards the Point is a King of the Buttons production for 93.7 Express FM.